Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Earlier this year, Jeff Merkley did something that's become pretty rare for a high-profile Democrat. He announced that he would not be running for president. The junior senator from Oregon had been mentioned as a possible contender after making a name for himself as a vocal opponent of the Trump administration. He filibustered one of the president's Supreme Court nominees for 15 hours, and he was out front on family separation at the border. But instead of joining the dozens of politicians vying for the nomination, Merkley chose to focus on his re-election to the Senate. Why? Because the upper chamber is broken, he says, and he believes he can help fix it. Philip Rucker, White House bureau chief for the Washington Post, spoke to the senator about that decision and what it will take to make Congress work again. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and BECU. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hey, greetings, folks.
Hi, everybody. It's good to be with you here. Good to be in Seattle. And thanks to Crosscut for making this great day possible. And thank you to you, Senator Merkley, for coming all the way from faraway Oregon to be with us today. He just mentioned the question process, and I would encourage all of you to submit some questions as we go along. I've got an iPad here, and we'll be keeping track of them. And in our discussion, I'll intersperse them in with the questions that I've prepared myself. So I look forward to getting to all the things on your mind. And Senator, I thought we'd start by talking a little bit about some of the big issues in the news right now. Everyone's probably heard of Robert Mueller and and the Russia investigation, and you've just come back from Washington where that's what a lot of your colleagues seem to be talking about these days. And so I'm wondering if you've read the report, I assume you have, and do you think that the special counsel has laid out enough evidence for the Congress to begin considering impeachment of President Trump for obstruction of justice? Mm-hmm.
Well, if you read the report, you'll find at least 10 instances of obstruction. And Mueller did not decide to say whether he would, under normal circumstances, indict an individual based on these 10 incidences. I want Mueller to testify before Congress, and I want to answer the question. If this wasn't President of the United States, would you indict this individual? Because we need to know from the kind of the professional side how they evaluate where it got to. But it looks to me, it's a vastly extensive set of information that the House needs to because the House is the impeachment side, the Senate is the jury side. But I want the House to act intensively and act quickly, evaluate it, and decide what they're going to do. And because I'm going to be on the jury, I won't say exactly how I feel that my instincts are, but I can tell you it looks like a whole lot of corrupted behavior in that report.
Yeah, and I realize you're in the Senate and not making this decision, but looking at the choice that your colleagues in the House have to make, there seem to be two schools of thought, right? There's the school that says the evidence in the special counsel report is so disturbing, it may be criminal, it's something that they need to seriously take up. And then there's another school of thought that says, hold up, let's do this in a political process. Let's wait until the 2020 election and defeat Donald Trump at the ballot box, that it would not be politically smart for Democrats to pursue impeachment proceedings at this stage. Where do you fall in that debate? It's something that's clearly dividing the Democrats in the House right now.
Well, my instinct is to execute your responsibilities. When something as significant as the checks and balances of our Constitution are at stake, when you have a president who's absolutely trying to undermine that by not allowing members of the administration to testify, by not submitting information that has been subpoenaed, you add to that challenge of we're approaching a constitutional conflict. I do feel if the House is going to act, I want them to act intensively, I want them to act quickly, and then they can send it over to the Senate, and they can focus on housing, healthcare, education, living wage, jobs, the Equality Act, taking on carbon pollution, and all the things we're going to get done in 2021.
Good. We're going to get to a few of those issues in a minute, but I want to stick with Russia for a second here, because President Trump had an important phone conversation yesterday. He talked for an hour with President Putin, and they talked about a range of topics. They talked about, in the president, in Trump's words, the Russian hoax. But President Trump did not confront Putin about the 2016 election interference by the Russians. As you know, intelligence agencies in the United States say that Russia will try to do this again and will try to interfere in the 2020 election, and yet President Trump is not confronting Putin on that. Do you view this as a dereliction of duty? And how concerned are you, as someone who will be on the ballot next year, but also as a United States senator, with the threat of election interference again?
You know, it's a complete dereliction of duty. For the president to dismiss a foreign power having intervened massively in an election, that in itself is horrific. But what's even worse is to not go all out to stop it from happening the next time. We need a president who is an absolute watchdog for America, not a lapdog for Putin.
And one more question in this realm, which has to do with Attorney General Barr. He had a pretty fiery testimony this week in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I was watching a lot of it on television. And it's interesting that, you know, they go back and forth from Republican senator to Democratic senator, and you hear the Republican senator's questions, and they're focused on Hillary's emails, on the coup against President Trump, on the origins of the investigation. And then you hear the questions from the Democratic side, and it has to do with the Mueller report and the substance of report and the decisions, the prosecutorial decision that Barr made not to charge the president with either conspiracy or obstruction of justice. And can you just talk a little bit about your impressions of Barr's testimony, but also about the polarization, sort of the tribal nature with which Washington and the country is dealing with this important question about Russia?
Yeah, I'm profoundly disappointed in my Republican colleagues for not standing up for the vision of our Constitution, not standing up for the morality in office, not standing up for the checks and balances they have responsibility for. What Barr did to campaign for the office of AG, basically laying out the case for an imperial presidency, then be selected as AG, then to completely mischaracterize the Mueller report, then to lie to Congress. He lied to Congress saying he had no idea why Mueller was dissatisfied with his four-page briefing when Mueller had called him and Mueller had written to him. So once you lie to Congress under oath, you don't belong anywhere close to the Department of Justice, certainly not the Attorney General of the United States of America. So the tribal part, it's a big problem. We have the challenge of news media, the television that is split far apart. That's reinforced by social media. I do a town hall in every county of Oregon every year. We have 36 counties, 22 are very, very red. So I'm in front of very red audiences all the time talking about these issues and trying to connect across that chasm. It's very challenging. It's very challenging for America. I must say the president's attack on the press, on the mainstream press, is trying to give a fair, accurate story to America, is another part of the problem, these kind of dictatorial, imperial instincts of Trump that we all have a responsibility to push back against. And thank you for being part of the responsible, capable press informing America.
Thank you. And by the way, we're going to be, some of my colleagues on the White House beat and I are going to be talking a little bit about the challenges of covering the Trump White House in a different session this afternoon at 2:45 for anyone who's interested. Just to pin you down on something you just said about Barr, you said he doesn't deserve to be the Attorney General, shouldn't be the Attorney General given what he did. Should he resign, or should the Senate take some sort of action to remove him from his position?
The Senate can't take action because it would be impeachment. It would start in the House. I think he should resign.
I guess that's right.
Absolutely. He should resign.
Okay. So a lot of folks may not realize, but you were, I believe, the first senator to visit the border and see the children being taken away from their families at the border last year. and really drove that that debate in the immediate aftermath of that news. And I'm wondering, you know, it's now been almost a year, about 8 or 9 months since this policy began. What has surprised you about the state of the border today and about the way the Trump administration is managing this process?
So just 13 days into office, the first indication occurred of the administration planning a child separation policy. And then in March 2017, John Kelly, then head of Homeland Security, gave a press conference with CNN, or a conversation with CNN, said, yes, we're planning to do this. In all that was happening in those first few months, it kind of got missed by the American public, but there was some reaction. And then the policy went underground. They launched it. The IG for HHS says that possibly thousands of kids were separated before the official policy started in May of 2018. This whole idea, as laid out from the very beginning, was if we do this to them, that is, to mistreat them, to take children away from their parents, to traumatize the parents and traumatize the children, we will send a message of deterrence. That is not acceptable under any moral code, any religious tradition. It's the most dark and evil thing I've ever seen come out of the U.S. And when I went down and walked in and saw the kids being sorted into those chain link cages, the Washington Post, by the way, gave me Pinocchios for calling them cages. I was right; they were wrong. But they weren't new. What the physical infrastructure wasn't new. What was new was the child separation. And to stand in front of a 30 by 30 foot chain link cage with, well, probably about 15 kids, and to say, are these kids you took away from their parents? And they're like, well, not all of them. Some came across the border themselves, but the rest, yes. And the shortest one was in front because they were lining up by height to get a meal. And he was maybe 4 years old. It was just knee high to a grasshopper. And I said, well, where do you do this? I said, well, we bring in the family through that door, and then we take them apart. So the court ended. The public reaction and the court ended at the end of June, child separation, for the most part. It's still going on. There's been hundreds of kids since who have been separated on fallacious grounds. But the idea the administration is pursuing now is family internment camps. The president's executive order from last June said we're going to provide a regulatory track, a legislative track, and a court track to try to do a vast system of family internment camps. And this actually was passed by the House of Representatives last year. And there were 37 Republican senators signed on a bill to establish these family internment camps. I went to the floor and laid out the history of internment camps in America, the history of Japanese American camps, and said, if you proceed on this, it will be an all-out battle. And at a level, you have seen nothing to think of what the battle will be. And the Republicans dropped it, and now the Democratic House has blocked it. But he's still trying to do this. And we in America must stand up for the decent and humane treatment of migrants fleeing persecution around the world when they arrive on the borders of the United States of America.
Senator Lockheed, am I pronouncing that right? Lockheed has a question that pertains to this that I thought I'd ask, which is, first of all, Lockheed says, thank you for your persistence with the immigration issue at the border. If you get the majority in 2020, meaning the Democrats take over control of the Senate, what will you do to permanently solve the DACA issue for Dreamers?
Yes. Thank you, Lockheed. And are you out there somewhere? Thank you for raising the question. We're going to pass the bill, and we had bipartisan support before the president pulled the rug out from under it. So I think we can get the bill relatively quickly. Dreamers, children who came to the United States at a young age, know no other country. We want them to be successful in the United States of America, and that means full ability to participate in our society with a pathway to full citizenship. That's the bill we want to pass. We want to get it done fast. Living in limbo is totally unfair to these dreamers who are living and working with us, and we have to get that accomplished as one of the first things we do in January 2021. Thank you.
Great. I want to pivot for just a minute to presidential politics. You made a decision earlier this year after traveling around the country and considering a run for president yourself that you would not run for president and instead would seek re-election next year to the Senate. And can you just tell us a little bit about why you made that choice? You seem to be the only Democrat in America not running for president.
Yeah, the only senator. That's how it feels.
There are seven senators running for president, and we'll get to that in a minute. But why did you decide not to?
So I first saw the Senate function when I was an intern in the 1970s. And then I worked for Congress in the 1980s on strategic nuclear issues because I felt the biggest threat to the planet was it would be destroyed by nuclear war. And the what I saw was a Senate that worked as a legislative body. It does not work today. You all may have heard of the apocryphal phrase attributed to Washington. The Senate is a cooling saucer. It's not a cooling saucer today. It is a deep freeze. Mitch McConnell is serving as the ground reaper. Grand Reaper? That's not the right
word. The Grim Reaper.
Grim Reaper.
That's probably what you mean.
Grim. of legislation. Yeah. He's turning in the Senate into a graveyard. All we are doing is voting on judges as he packs the court from the very right wing. And let me tell you what this means. This means justices who are not defending the Constitution, instead justices that are bending the vision of America to be a nation by and for the powerful rather than the people. And this court packing is horrific. It was done at the presidential level or the Supreme Court level with the theft of a Supreme Court seat. And then the jamming through of Kavanaugh, who is totally unfit to serve on any court anywhere. He's partisan, he's angry, he's prejudiced. And so we have got to restore the Senate to being a legislative body. That is the only, so I think of these, there's three big issues that I feel like we have to take on. One is the corruption of our democracy, and that's the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, and the dark money. If we don't take those things on, we will lose on everything else. Second big crisis is investment in families, housing, healthcare, education, living wage, jobs. And quite frankly, those have been missing from the equation. We saw in 2017 a tax bill that took $1.5 trillion, or $2 trillion if you include interest, out of the federal treasury and gave it to the richest Americans. That is government by and for the powerful, not the people. How about if we get that money back and we invest it in healthcare and housing and education and living wage jobs? And the third massive crisis is carbon. In my lifetime, if you all in this room take a deep breath of air, that breath has 30% more carbon in it than when I was born. And we are accelerating into oblivion. We are not close to taking on this challenge in America or partnering with the world. So we have to have a Senate that can do those things. If we can have the best person in the Oval Office, but if they face the type of that individual, he or she faces the obstruction that comes from Mitch McConnell, we will not succeed in tackling on these three big issues. And that's why I feel like the right mission for me is to try to make the Senate functional and a full partner with a great president in January 2021.
Senator, I want to drill down a little bit on one of those three crises that you mentioned, the democracy crisis. It's not something we hear a lot of national political figures talking a lot about. On the campaign trail, there are very few candidates making this a core message. I think Pete Buttigieg, the mayor from Indiana, is an exception to that. But you've proposed overturning Citizens United, ending gerrymandering, abolishing the Electoral College to have a popular vote to elect presidents. Why is that? Why are those steps so fundamental to addressing these other issues? A lot of people would say, oh, the economic issue is the most important, or the climate issue. The Governor Inslee is running for president on the climate issue alone. But why does fixing democracy and reforming government matter so much?
When I think about the possibility of successfully take on climate, for example, it depends upon having government by and for the people, not government by and for the Koch brothers. Now, when I ran in 2014, the Koch brothers came to Oregon. They spent probably around $5 million beating me up in every possible way behind all these front groups. And I said to my team, I'm going to put up an ad against the Koch brothers. And they said, oh, Jeff, please don't do that because they are so powerful. They could put $50 million in the race against you. And I said, I don't care. If I'm if I'm going to lose, I'm going to go down swinging. And I put up an ad saying the out-of-state oil and coal billionaires, Koch brothers, have come to Oregon to elect my opponent, Monica Webby, because they share an agenda.
And she really was one of their big recruits. She was going to be it.
And I'm so glad she talked a lot about the things that she supported that were Koch brothers, because it gave me a great campaign ad. And I was able to say, great investment for the Koch brothers, terrible choice for Oregon. They hated being called out. It's the first time in U.S. history that a senator or a House member has called them out in a campaign ad. We knocked them out of Oregon. We need to knock them out of every state in the United States of America. But you can't just do it through campaign ads. So the Supreme Court is at the heart of this trouble. They've done nothing on gerrymandering, which means there's a vast misrepresentation in Congress of where the people stand with so many gerrymandered states. There's some on the blue side. There's a lot more on the red side. So you have a corrupted representation in the House of Representatives. And then you have this issue of voter suppression. Supreme Court, what do? They gutted the Voting Rights Act. And we see all kinds of strategies to keep Native Americans from voting, students from voting, low-income communities from voting, minority communities from voting. If you believe in our Constitution, you believe in voter empowerment, not voter suppression. So we have to restore the ability to vote. And this third piece, the hardest piece, is the Koch brother piece. It is the Citizens United money unleashed. And it goes to the heart of the destruction of our Constitution. Jefferson talked about the fact that you have to have distributed power across the electorate. Now, there were a lot of people who didn't get to vote who should have been able to vote. So that was a big flaw. But the idea of distributed power, he called it equal voice. He called it the mother principle. He said it's essential to having laws that reflect the will of the people. The Supreme Court, supposed to defend that vision, proceeded to concentrate power with billionaires able to put hundreds of millions of dollars in. Complete opposite. They have stood our Constitution on its head. They have shredded it, and we have to reclaim it. So let's reclaim our Constitution and government by and for the people so we can take on these other issues. Okay. And in the Senate, we have the For the People Act, which is the counterpart to H.R. 1 that was in the House. Tom Udall, New Mexico, and myself are the leads on it. We got every blue Democrat, to sign on, and we couldn't get a single Republican. Why is that? Mitch McConnell called his caucus in and basically said, no one can sign up on this bill to restore democracy. It is the complete reflection of the Koch brother control of the U.S. Senate. They are the puppet masters, not the people, and the people have to take the Senate back. That's why I want to be part of it.
Yeah. At the risk of getting a little nerdy here, I just want to talk for a minute about the Senate filibuster. It's been a big issue for many years. You were once a champion of eliminating that 60-vote requirement in order to get votes on some of President Obama's nominees when Republicans were trying to block that. There's now a debate among Democrats about whether the Senate should gut this requirement altogether in order to eventually pass through bills like Medicare for All. Where do you fall on the filibuster rules?
So when you hear the term filibuster, you think of people speaking forever, and that's not really what it is. It's a supermajority barrier to completing work on a bill. I argued that we should go back to the early principle, and I call it the talking filibuster, that you listen to everyone, but when everyone stops talking, you go to simple majority vote. The talking filibuster could restore the fact that it would be rarely used because people don't want to spend all night there. Right now, you have to get a supermajority to sneeze in the Senate, so that's part of what's created the deep freeze. I now believe that we have to eliminate it completely on issues related to defending our Constitution, because the Koch brothers have such a firm grip on the minority. If they're Republicans, they end up in the minority, they have such a firm grip. They will use that minority status to completely block the reforms to restore voting rights, take on gerrymandering, take on dark money, make it visible, have any sort of a matching grant program for small dollar candidates. So if Mitch McConnell is going to destroy the Constitution by simple majority, we have to restore it by simple majority.
Okay.
First thing we need to do is January.
Okay. So the economy, There was some big news yesterday, the unemployment report. 263,000 new jobs, 3.6% unemployment rate. That's the lowest since 1969. If you hear President Trump and read his tweets, which is my job to read his tweets, he will tell you that this is a booming historic economy that everybody's feeling. But I was talking to you backstage a little bit, and you know, you live in a blue-collar neighborhood in Portland where you grew up, the same neighborhood. It seems like people there aren't feeling this boom. And my question for you is, how do we equate the sort of numbers and indicators that we're hearing out of Washington that the economy is so great with the reality that a lot of people in Portland and Seattle, everywhere else in the country, are you know, struggling to make ends meet? How do you explain that dichotomy?
Well, first we should recognize that what we have right now is an artificial sugar high that comes from the vast stimulus that goes to the richest Americans through the tax bill. The Republicans fought like crazy Obama's stimulus when we had massive unemployment. And then the moment they were in power, they did a much larger stimulus for the wealthiest people in the country, the biggest corporations. So we have that artificial pumping up. And when you have an artificial high, there's going to be a crash. And so it's going to wear itself out at some point. I'm sure Trump is hoping that that is after November of next year. The deficit has gone from around $450 or so billion per year to over $1 trillion in 2 years from giving money away to the richest people in our country. You know, in all these town halls I hold, I'll hit close to 400 this year. I probably will hit 400 this year in Oregon, and nobody's ever stood up. I have this great idea. Let's go borrow a ton of money and give it to the people who need it the least. If anybody wants to argue for that proposition, well, that's an argument I'd be happy to have. So here we are with an economy artificially propped up, producing a massive, massive deficit when we should be investing in the fundamentals of healthcare and housing and education infrastructure and creating good paying jobs in the course of it, and infrastructure in the Green New Deal side of that equation as well. So in my, as you mentioned, my blue-collar community on the east side of Portland, my kids went to the same schools I went to. It's the same post-World War II three-bedroom ranch houses. At the time my family moved in, my dad was a mechanic. For twice his wage, you could buy a house. Twice his annual wages, you could buy a house. Now the ratio for a working person in my community is about 5-1 to 6-1. So people are giving up on home ownership. At the time I got out of high school, if you worked a minimum wage job, you could afford tuition at a public university in Oregon. Now you can't even come close to that. So debt was not an issue for college education when I got to high school. Now people are working part-time jobs, and every week they have to worry about meshing the schedules. And one of their bosses is saying, well, if you don't show up, we'll fire you because there's plenty of other people that can get a job. So the stress in the life on housing, on healthcare, on education, on the workplace, all of it is much higher than it was 40 years ago. We've had 40 years in which the elite of society have gone like this, and working folks have gone flat or more stressful downward. So we have to completely restructure what we're doing. We did have three decades after World War II that generally the workers got a fair share of the wealth they were working to create. The last four decades, they have been ripped off, and they're struggling as a result. That's the reality in blue-collar America, and it's not pretty.
Okay.
And let's change it.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we've got about 20 minutes left, and here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go through a couple of questions that you guys have. There's some smart ones here. And then I want to save a little time at the end to talk about the 2020 presidential race. To start with, there are two questions that are similar. I think Jules is asking, why aren't the Republicans in the Senate standing up to Trump's lies? And hold that thought for now. I can't find it. Oh, Lisa, any theories on what happened to Lindsey Graham?
Okay, standing up to Trump's lies. So it's so interesting to have Republican colleagues whisper to us about how disturbed they are But the fact is they're whispering and they're talking to us. They're not shouting and they're not talking to the American public. And what they will say is, look, the Tea Party base is more than 50% of our primary electorate. Our re-election depends on them. And we watched what happened to Bob Corker and to Jeff Flake. And when they spoke up against the president, they got trashed by their base. And we're not going to do the same thing because we want to keep, quote, serving. And I put it in quotes because, I mean, to me, serving means you're serving the people. Means you have to stand up on tough issues and take stands, even when they're unpopular. And but the answer, the core answer, is they're afraid of their base. That's the answer. And what was the second half?
What happened to Lindsey Graham?
So, Lindsey is, one, heading into a re-election cycle, and two, is finding his voice and how he's going to play a key central role now that he's by himself rather than as a kind of a partnership with John McCain, because we unfortunately lost John this last year. And so he's figuring those two things out.
Okay, good. A regional question.
And I want to add something.
Yeah.
If you look behind these headlines, and Lindsey is playing a very constructive role in several places, and so just as whatever you hear in the public, also keep in mind he's doing some very helpful work behind the scenes.
Like what?
That's behind the scenes. That's why.
Oh, it's a secret.
I want him to keep doing good work.
Okay.
Tell me good work.
Okay. Here's a regional question from Dale, which is, do you support the development of a Cascadian high-speed passenger rail between Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, and Spokane?
You know, this question of the high-speed rail takes me back to going with a congressional delegation to China when China had done its first high-speed link from Beijing to Tianjin on the coast of China. And so we took the train, and we're on it, and it's going 200 miles per hour, and the utility poles and just flashing by, and it's scary because I think if this thing crashes, I'm so dead. But from that initial piece of high-speed rail, they've kept building high-speed rail in China. And I'm going to have you each answer this question to yourself here about, take a guess about how many miles of high-speed rail, how many bullet train miles are there in China now? Now, I'm going to tell you, in America, we have zero. Zilch, none. So they went from that first link in Beijing a few years ago, and how many miles do they have now? So you have, if you have the numbers fixed in your head, how many said above 10,000? Raise your hands. A few hands. How many said above 15,000? No hands. Well, two hands. They have 16,000 miles of bullet train. They are taking the proceeds that come from the advantages we gave them over U.S. corporations in the American marketplace. The vast resources that come to China from that. They are doing huge investment in their infrastructure. They're buying up strategic assets around the world. And what are we getting? We're getting companies that go out of business or go to China or elsewhere. Yes, let's build some bullet trains. It makes a lot of sense here in the United States of America.
Well, there you go. Ted, and this goes back to the democracy crisis question. Ted wants to know, are term limits in Congress an effective reform to improving democracy?
They are absolutely not, Ted. We had term limits in Oregon. When I first ran for the legislature, I ran for a seat that was vacant because of term limits. I voted for them as a voter before I was in office. And so when I arrived in the legislature, I was seeing the effects of term limits. And here's what I saw. What I saw is it shifted the power to the lobbyists. They became the institutional voice. It's a consequence I didn't anticipate when I supported trying out the idea. But to hear those lobbyists, and because I come from the policy side of the world and was following Oregon pretty closely, it became so clear to me how they would sit down and say, well, now, none of your colleagues were here, but here's what really happened 3 years ago. I'm like, that's not what happened. And they're like, oh, okay, well, don't tell the rest of your House members that's not what really happened because they're lobbying, right? So moving the center of power to the lobby doesn't work. It was an interesting idea to try out. Doesn't work.
So it turns out Ted is a prolific questioner because he has another one that a lot of people want to hear an answer to, which is, beyond the ballot box, how can we mitigate the assaults on our rule of law and general erosion in democratic norms in our country? What can citizens do to address this issue besides voting for a new president?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about climate for a moment. So one is be engaged, because once you're engaged in one piece, it will draw you into other pieces. So, for example, everybody can change their household. You can change your hot water heater, your furnace to a heat pump, get a plug-in car, sign up for green electrons, change your light bulbs, and you've just made a big difference. Then go to your community college board, or a college board, or a city council, or a local corporation, and say, do a 100% resolution and a 2 to 3 year action plan. And the Sierra Club is helping people all across the country do this. So you can make a big difference in grassroots carbon policy before a legislature even takes action. And certainly let's not wait for the federal Congress, because for the reasons we've talked about, the Koch brothers control it on the Senate side. So there's that. Then it's like, once you're engaged in that fashion and you're organizing, somebody comes up to you and say, well, help so-and-so run for office, then do it. And then they say, well, you should run. Well, do that too. Because we can't be on the sidelines. Our country's in trouble. Our planet's in trouble. We've got to save it. So I know you're not on the sidelines because you're here, but make sure your friends aren't curled up on the couch with a pillow over their heads, because it's so tempting to do that for the next couple of years. Instead, we have to be deeply, deeply engaged.
So in terms of being engaged, you've got, as we talked about earlier, 22 Democrats running for president in 2020. And 4 years ago this time, you were the only senator in the U.S. Senate to support Bernie Sanders. Why have you not endorsed him yet this time? What's holding you back?
Well, I absolutely love Bernie, and I wish he was president right now. So I feel my most valuable role right now is to take these three crises that I spent last year crisscrossing the country and talking about: democracy, investment in families, taking on carbon, and try to get every presidential candidate to take them very seriously, to have detailed plans how they're going to undertake them. You mentioned that Pete Buttigieg, thank you. that he is now talking about democracy. Well, I was at many functions with him where I gave this speech, so I'm glad he's listening to me.
I think he heard your speech, yeah.
And Beto O'Rourke did my three crises speech just after I withdrew from running. So I'm like, okay.
Did he learn the hand gestures from you, the arms?
No. Okay. No. I expect him to like take off. Like that would be a hilarious video, by the way, if he arranged that kind of like,
yeah,
start gesturing and then start floating off the stage. They all suggest it to him, but that's why I think I want to help drive the conversation for the entire Democratic field, and I think I can best do that without advancing a particular candidate at this moment in time.
Okay. So. When we, when my colleagues and I interview Democratic voters around the country, or we survey them in polls, a lot of Democrats say they want a change. They want somebody who's going to just change the way things are working, or in a lot of cases, not working in Washington. And I want to ask you about Vice President Biden, because he joined the United States Senate in 1973. That's nearly a half century ago. Is he the kind of change agent that the Democratic Party needs?
That's up to the Democrats across America. But I think every candidate that's out there has the ability to take on these three crises I'm talking about. I will look forward to hearing Biden talk about them. If he is not engaged in all three, that would disturb me a great deal, and that will inform my answer to you at some later point in time. I know he gets the plight of working America. That's one of the three. So I want to hear him talk about the democracy side and the carbon side as well.
But help folks out a little bit. Like, who is addressing these three issues? Who's exciting you? Who's surprising you at this stage? Who do you have your eye on? You can't be looking at all 22 at once.
Well, I know a good share of these 22. I am not going to endorse for a long time to come. And so I feel like I'm listening to how America responds to folks. People bring different backgrounds, different passions, different skill sets. It's very interesting set of individuals who are there, and I think it's going to get sorted out as we proceed. So I'm dodging your. You notice I'm dodging your.
He's dodging a lot of these questions, but this one I don't think you'll have to dodge. You know, Donald Trump in his 2016 campaign shattered a lot of norms, and he seemed to possibly change the rules of politics. I mean, all of a sudden it was okay to harass and assault women and get elected president. It was okay to lie about things and get elected president. It was okay to be accused of shady business practices and get elected president. Have the rules changed for the Democratic primary process, do you think? Should the Democratic candidates be held to a higher standard than that? Or are we in sort of an anything goes world of politics now that's forever changed?
When you say suddenly it's okay, it's not okay. Not okay. None of those things are okay.
And to be clear, I'm not making a judgment about whether they're okay or not. I'm saying the American people elected him president. So enough people in the Electoral College of America thought that was okay.
And now we're going to unelect him. And let me talk about direct popular vote for a moment. You raised it earlier. I did put in a constitutional amendment that said let's go to direct popular vote. I know that a constitutional amendment has no path through the Senate at this point, but I wanted to put it in to make the point that this is something we must change. The Electoral College had a fairly dark set of motivations behind it originally, and it was tied into the slave power in the South, and it did something that probably people couldn't have envisioned, which was that it meant that candidates for the presidency do not go, if they are a blue or red candidate, they do not go to states that are clearly blue and clearly red. They go to states, the swing states, which means that essentially many Americans, almost I'd say the majority of Americans, are not at the center of the conversation, and they're certainly not equal participants in the conversation. If you have popular vote, every single vote matters in every state. Every Democrat wants to go every place, including the red territory. Every red candidate wants to go everywhere, including the blue territory. Every American is equally able to have a significant voice on the outcome. And that's the way it should be. And that's why I'm so proud that Oregon this year is going to join the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, in which states allocate their electoral votes to the person who wins the popular vote, because that's the only way we're going to get there. And I think Washington State's already done that, but they haven't. Please make it happen. And we are now up to about 200 of the 270 votes we need to implement this. So we need 70 more electoral votes to be allocated to the winner of the popular vote.
An interesting idea. So we've got a few minutes left, and I want to do something a little fun, which is not going to be asking you to make an endorsement. I know you're not endorsing anybody, but there are 7 of your colleagues who are running for president, and you probably know them a lot better than we do. And so I want to just go through those 7 senators and tell us one thing that we may not know about them. Sort of pull back the curtain a little bit. And I'll do alphabetical order because he's not choosing favorites. So we're going to start with Michael Bennett, who announced his campaign just a couple days ago, the senator from Colorado. What's something we may not know about Michael Bennett that we should know?
He did an incredible job as superintendent of the school system in Denver, which he jumped into to work very hard to improve education. It's near and dear to his heart.
Okay. And Cory Booker, New Jersey?
Cory Booker is the most motivational speaker I have ever heard.
Does he talk that way in the cloakroom?
Yes. he's speaking from his heart on all of these big issues we face. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Kirsten Gillibrand, New York.
Kirsten wrote a book with keywords, which is Off the Sidelines. And she was addressing it specifically to women in America, but applies to everyone in America.
What do you mean by that?
That means none of us in this Democratic Republic can afford not to be engaged.
Okay. And what's something we should know about Kamala Harris? from California.
Kamala Harris has a prosecutor's background that she brings to bear really well in the Judiciary Committee. And if you saw her interaction with Barr the other day, she was awesome.
Does she, I mean, we see these hearings that are on television, the sort of high-profile hearings where she does have these powerful exchanges with witnesses, but is she that way in smaller settings? I mean, have you ever seen her debate her colleagues across the aisle or question other witnesses? Does she have that same approach?
I think she brings that kind of let's get right to the heart of it approach to every issue she works on. You know, the style is going to differ if you and I are talking by ourselves and it's a room full of people, but it's a no-nonsense, let's get to the heart of the challenge.
And Amy Klobuchar, also on a Judiciary Committee from Minnesota.
Amy is has kind of the most sharpened sense of humor of any member of the caucus. She is recruited to do these various media gatherings. Have you ever been at one?
I have. She spoke at the Gridiron Dinner, which is the sort of off-the-record annual media dinner. It's been going on for 100 years or something.
When the media
it's
thinks
very
about
funny speech.
Who to bring... She has a way of looking at the world that is just connects with people. She is like the first people think of when you want a humorous speech about serious issues. She's a serious person, I'm like the last. I'm like the worst.
Have you ever spoken at the Gridiron?
Nobody would invite me to the
Gridiron. Maybe they will.
Yeah. No. So, and she also brings this kind of Midwestern sensibility the challenges that are faced in the heartland.
And Bernie Sanders, he may be the one you know the best.
I know Bernie pretty well.
4 years ago.
You know, Bernie, what I so much love is that he has argued this case for restoring democracy for the people and these key issues. And of course, healthcare is the one you hear about most. But when I was putting forward my Keep It in the Ground bill and my 100% bill to go completely to renewable energy and laying it, 320-page bill, I invited both Hillary and Bernie to come and kick it off. Bernie came both times. Hillary didn't either time. And I say that just to say he isn't just talking about healthcare. He's talking about income inequality, wealth inequality, how we reshape our entire economy, how we have a healthcare system that isn't twice as expensive and less effective than any other democracy. How do we take on the price gouging that is done by the pharmaceutical companies? Isn't it outrageous that we pay for the research on which a lot of the development of drugs is based? And yet we pay more for those drugs than anyone else in the developed world. Shouldn't we get the best prices, not the worst prices? And, I mean, he has been working on these issues forever in a very powerful, consistent way. If you look, when I was a Democratic leader in Oregon, and the Republicans controlled the House forever, so this is the state House, I argued that the way to approach politics is you lay out the things you believe in as your agenda, you campaign on them, you win on them, you do them, and then after you do them, you run on the fact you did them. So it was like run, serve, run in a consistent fashion. That is the exact opposite of Donald Trump. Donald Trump says whatever the hell he wants when he campaigns. He doesn't believe anything and then changes everything once he's in office. And the list is long. But the integrity factor is so important in America, I think every Democrat running ranks up here in integrity to our occupant of the Oval Office. We're in a moment of dark disgrace, and we need to put an end to it. And if it's not been done by impeachment, we need to do it in November next year.
Okay. And we got through six of them. There's one left. Elizabeth Warren, the W, from Massachusetts. What do we not know about her that we should know?
Well, I think you know that she's a massive champion for consumers and that she put forward the idea of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. When she was going to Senate offices to try to get people to champion that, she came to me. And the story she tells about how she went to office after office, and they say, well, that's a great idea, Elizabeth, but too bad it'll never happen. But she kept at it. She kept at it in a complete, consistent way. She came to my office, and I said, that's a great idea. Let's get it done. And Dodd had brought me on to the banking committee to take on the predatory home loans.
Chris Dodd,
because I kept standing up in caucus and saying, we've got to end these triple option loans and these teaser rate loans. We've got to end the kickbacks and servicers. The mortgage industry is turning home ownership into a nightmare. But I guess I wanted to say, she doesn't just put out great ideas. She works them continuously. And if you watch the pictures of the floor of the Senate, you will probably see nobody who's talking more on both sides of the aisle, finding partners everywhere, which you might not be something that you would expect. But she can connect with both sides to build partnerships to get things done.
And what is her pitch, sort of senator to senator? How does she make those arguments in private?
Well, very much from a policy point of view, and I come from the policy side, so I like that. It's like, this will work, and here's why. And now let's work together to get it done. And that's like what a legislature is supposed to be. what a concept.
What a legislature, okay.
What a concept.
Okay. Well, that I think does it. We're just about out of time. And I just really want to thank you, Senator, for being here with us.
I want to thank all of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming out and being part of the conversation.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.